Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have two sponsors this week. Woofu, my tech alma mater, the world's best form builder. I love that they sponsor this show. WUFOO.com, like Wu-Tang and the Foo Fighters, right? It's a web form builder. So build any kind of form you want, from a simple contact form to big payment-taking forms, multi-page forms. Embed them on any website. It's awesome. WUFOO.com. And Environments for Humans, they have an all CSS conference too. Me and Dave went to it last time while I was in Hawaii. This time it is in, gosh, where is that? Is
Denver, just outside Denver, I think.
Yeah, so cool. It's October 21st through 23rd. So definitely check that out. Conferences that are so specific about one topic are so awesome. Zoe Gillenwater, Eric Meyer, Nicole Sullivan, Jonathan Snook, Estelle Weil, Tab Atkins. Wow. It's going to be sweet. Go check that out at 2013.cssdevconf.com. For now, let's kick things off.
Dear listener, you have stumbled into the Shop Talk Show, a podcast about front-end web design development. I'm Dave Rupert. With me is Chris Coyer.
Hi, everybody.
And today is not a normal episode. It is one of our famous episodes, another rapid fire episode.
Oh, that's so great. I'm glad that that sound is stuck around. I'm sure you just Googled it one time and just found one and put it on there. And now It's taken on a life of its own, you know?
It's a thing. It's the next to owning my own Uzi. This is the best, the best thing.
It's just a lot safer too.
Yeah. My dog would not be handling an Uzi in the house very well.
Like Dave said, it is a rapid fire show. We're going to try to do as many questions as we possibly can. No guests, no drama, no links, nothing. Just all questions. So let's just jump into it right away. Dimitri Ganoff.
What would you suggest using to concatenate JavaScript files for moving code into production? I mainly work on Windows machines, so that may limit my options. Require.js looks like a good solution, but I haven't tried it out yet. Thanks.
Cool. So concatenating JavaScript files, it's good you're even thinking about that. Of course, if you write JavaScript, in larger projects, it's often written in little tiny little bits, you know, and then you know, when you serve it out to the main website, you shouldn't be loading like 10 or 12 JavaScript files. You should be loading like one or two JavaScript files. So that's what concatenation is all about. But when you work locally, it's kind of nice to not do that, you know, so that you can perhaps even in your local environment, you really are loading 12, because speed isn't as big of a deal and it's easier for debugging then. But then your build step, like when it goes out to those main servers, it kind of compiles all those. So I work on a Rails project where we use the Rails asset pipeline, which people like to hate on. But has been largely fine, you know, for us. And we write little statements in our JavaScript files, like require, literally, and then the path to where it lives in the assets folder. And so locally, we just link up all those scripts. But when it goes out, the Rails asset pipeline kind of squishes them all together and puts like a string in a random, you know, I don't even know if it's random. It's random looking to me. So it, next time we push, that number changes and it breaks the old cache. So the Rails asset pipeline can help you there, but that's Rails specific. I often work in CodeKit too, which squishes files together while working locally. So that works for me. Have you ever?
On Windows, I've only done stuff like where it's like a custom builder. It's not like out of the box stuff, but here's what I would say is, like Node is, there's a lot of effort being put. I think the Windows people are actually, 'cause Windows 8 has like a lot of JavaScript. They're putting a lot of effort and dollars behind Node and NPM. So I got to think any sort of Grunt style plugin, like Grunt can run Require.js. So kind of what he was saying, I guess he mentioned Require.js. It's that easy. Like you can run everything. You can get Node going on your machine and you can install that through IIS or whatever, or what is it called? It's called like Web Tools or something. It's whatever you're using to install web software on your system. You can install Node just like that now, at least in Windows 8. So I guess I need to.
Yeah, so Node doesn't care if it's, you know, Node just runs on a server. It's doesn't Windows, Mac, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So
yeah.
So that means Grunt is an option for you and Grunt can certainly do this job.
Yeah. So like you just install the Require.js plugin and you point Grunt at your file folder and you can compile SAS, JavaScript, blah blah blah. You're in good shape. So
okay.
I think that's it.
Sure, and this is a great one. If somebody else is living, it works in Windows a lot and has a solution for this, just explain to us what you do in the comments.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Because I have like bits and pieces of a complete Windows environment, but I end up like in Visual Studio and stuff whenever I work on Windows, so a little different. So anyway, next question.
Billy Brown asks. I love that it cock is a different sound than you're just going to let it go.
Yeah.
Just going to hold it cocked. Okay.
Yeah.
I've heard of all these new HTML5 features such as history.pushState or local storage, but all of these seem to be JavaScript. In what way are they HTML and can't be called an addition to JavaScript? So it's why do we group things like the history API and the local storage and like app cache or whatever? Why are those called HTML5 when in Billy's mind, that's HTML is, I'm sure he's thinking of things like section and aside.
Right. So the best way I can explain this, this was told to me, I think by Tab Atkins or Paul Irish or somebody of that caliber. They said HTML 5 doesn't really exist without JavaScript. Like there are the elements and the attributes and all that stuff that the everyday HTML 5, but like Canvas, yep, it doesn't work without JavaScript, you know. The push state, like your browser is using push state to push its state to the next page or whatever, but we now have the ability to manipulate that. That's what's new. And the only way to manipulate is with JavaScript, if that makes sense. So,
it does indeed. Like HTML, like those new elements are nothing. They're all nearly irrelevant to HTML5. HTML5 is these new JavaScript features.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like local storage, is something the browser uses. So it is it's built into the browser. In HTML5, if you go to the HTML5 logo website and you look at all that HTML5 is, well, it's actually all these JavaScript APIs. It's actually all these like device things, all these, you know, kind of new features. Geolocation is HTML5, or maybe it's not. It is, but it's under that umbrella of like, this is what we're specking out to do. HTML5 is not just HTML anymore. CSS3 is actually included into HTML5. So mind blown there.
Yeah. And at that point, it was like a marketing decision just so that there was an easy thing to say that meant all of it. And a lot of us just kind of were like, okay, you know, there was definitely the angry blog posts in the beginning of like, CSS3 is not HTML. It's like ruining our minds and stuff. And then people are like, oh, yeah, but we're also busy working instead of caring about stupid naming semantics.
And you know,
it worked, too.
It works. It just works. I don't know. I mean, like, you can get frustrated, but, man, it's easier to sell HTML5 than it is history.pushState.
So an API like push state is easy to call HTML5, but and then it's easy to say, well, that's JavaScript then. But also, like, it's different in a way than like the language of JavaScript itself, right? Yeah, so there's ECMA script, which is the, like, I don't even understand how that it is JavaScript. Like, we should be using the word ECMAScript, but nobody likes to say that word, so we don't, right? But like, if there's going to be some new feature where there's a fat arrow in the thing and it maintains the context of this when you go through it, like a language change, that's something that happens in ECMAScript, or like some new array operator or something. That's, you would never call that HTML5, right? That's just like an evolution of ECMAScript. But if it's a totally new API, then they tend to lump it into HTML5.
Yeah. Like, the for loop is not HTML5. It's JavaScript.
Right.
But JavaScript being able to query the navigator's window location, which happens all the time, like, that's, or that is the API to HTML. Like, HTML is the browser. I hope that helped. Anyway.
It's just straight up is a little confusing. So Ben Demmeyer asks,
I work in e-commerce and my main role is building site templates, PSD to HTML, CSS, JavaScript, and I have a lot of reusable elements from site to site, such as product grids, etc. I have recently made the switch to SCSS and Sublime Text, and I was wondering what plugins or extensions for Sublime Text you find useful in your day-to-day workflow that could help me with easily replicating core SAS SCSS structures such as mixins, etc. You got any tips? You're
I'm not
hot
sure
on
that
Sublime here, right?
I do. I like Sublime Text, but I don't have Sublime Text manage reusable components for me. You know, I'm not sure you could, I guess, because you could build snippets, and snippets are cool. I actually just recently did a screencast on making a new Sublime Text snippet because I had never done that before. And I went through the process and it's pretty easy. They're just little files in Sublime Text. In fact, you can just go like, what is it? It doesn't matter.
I could type HTML tab and I'm spit out a whole HTML snippet, right? Or through the file menu, the command
and the authoring dash of them yourself is pretty not hard. It's like gives you a little template and you decide on what tab trigger you want. You know, just even like changing your settings in Sublime Text, you have to like edit that big JSON file, which is like probably at first was a convenience to the author, but now is kind of like a cool, I don't know, it's just kind of neat, you know. They'll probably leave it that way forever because it's nerdy and it's like, this is a way to enforce that only nerds can use this software.
I would write your own. I mean, or like for your language or your e-commerce system of choice, maybe. I mean, maybe you make the boilerplate Bootstrap for whatever, Lemon Stand or Magento.
Wouldn't you take a framework as separate from your code editor? Like you make your own framework, because I think you'll be happier with that than just like picking Bootstrap or whatever. But then let your framework be your framework, not your text editor.
Yeah. I mean, what I do, I mean, this happens to me daily. I just put something up online and I go on GitHub, actually open source it, so it'll get a little better over time, right? Then you just visit your GitHub and you copy and paste the code just that you forgot or whatever. Make a bunch of GIFs in GitHub, make a bunch of SCSS, whatever snippets and code snippets in CodePen. Hey,
oh, there you go.
Tied that in.
Yeah, I mean, that's a completely legit. I mean, there's lots of different things in CodePen that would help you do that too, like tag them in a certain way so they're all grouped together. Make a we have a feature called collections so that you can keep them all together, and that type of thing. So it's certainly that could be useful to you. Although it ends up being a copy and paste job then ultimately, because you got to move them out of CodePen. So
yeah, But do you want to weigh down your editor? Not like it's going to slow it down, but like, let's say in 2 years, Sublime Text dot cooler than old Sublime Text comes out, you know, and you have to migrate all your little doodads and whatnots. I mean, does that stick you into Sublime Text too? If like, whatever, not even Sublime Text, like Coda 9000 comes out and it's even better. You know, I don't know if you want to be tied, because I know a lot of people are, you know, we spend a lot of time tooling to an environment like Coda or TextMate or Sublime Text, you know, and, you know.
I could even bring CodeKit into this again. I know I mentioned a lot, but CodeKit even has its own like CodeKit project kind of deal for specifically for the shared assets across multiple projects kind of thing. Like if you have a set of user authored mixins that you use on all your projects, CodeKit has a thing to make that easier for you. But you know, legitimately that's a thing then that ties you to that project a little bit. And you know,
Well, anyway, that's a decision you can make, but, I think there's a lot out there, and I would specifically maybe talk to people in your network of whatever your e-commerce system is. And, you guys are probably all working on the same problem simultaneously or together, you know? So I would strengthen that up, and
you're going down the right path thinking about making your stuff more reusable though. So keep going.
Cool. Next question. Paul Sayer writes in.
Mm-hmm. Most back-end frameworks like WordPress use blocking code for things like SQL queries. This is how most software development has been for ages, and the industry has evolved tools to diagram this type of code, ER diagrams, flowcharts, etc. But now the browser model and JavaScript events introduced to us an asynchronous non-blocking code. Do you have any tricks for diagramming these sorts of web apps which require events, AJAX, timeouts, etc.? So pretty interesting question, Paul. I think, you know, he's saying that it was pretty easy to diagram something like a WordPress site, like he mentions, because you're like, okay, there's the home page, and if they click a blog article, it goes to this other template, and it, you know, it's blocking code, he calls it, just because like it has to reload the page, the query runs again, it finds the new content, it displays the new content in the new template. Mm-hmm. But you know, think of an app like Gmail these days. You know, you just hit C and get a new message, and type in some stuff, and new stuff appears, and you type in Dave Rhubarb and his name comes up, and then it shows his little image there, and you click it, and then you send it, and it just disappears, and a new thing at the top says message sent. There's all these things that are like being AJAXed in and out and gone, and never does the page refresh in Gmail ever. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. You have to really force it if you wanted to. How would you even go about diagramming that? That's what Paul is asking, and that's a good question.
I don't know. So this is my new mantra. I don't know if you can think about it in terms of a page, right? You have to break it down to the module, right? Like, what does this one module do? The email checker, what does that do? Well, it sits there every 1000 seconds. It'll fire an event to like check for emails, or it'll receive a push, you know? I think you'd have to diagram it and then kind of make it look like a loop every time. It looks like a circle, but I don't know. I don't do a lot of like diagramming in this sense, so I'm probably not the best, most qualified to talk about this, but
no, me either. So it would be interesting if somebody works on these one page apps, kind of how they go about it. I would suspect that you would draw out some of the more important states.
Mm-hmm.
And just be like, this is what the page is going to look like when the user has performed this very important action.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and I think, you know, you used to have like the classic one, like user goes to website. The website talks to the database disk tower. The database disk tower goes back to the website, which goes back to user. That's like the like linear thing that everyone sees. I mean, now I don't think you can... I mean, I think it has to be the module, and every module is actually going to do that. Like at some point it's going to talk to its controller, talk to its model, come back, and then spit out. So, and then it's like either it writes or it doesn't. I don't know. Yeah.
Huh. Depends on what the context is too. Are you trying to explain this to a room of people, or are you trying to do it for your own mind and your own head? Are you trying to go do a keynote presentation of this or whatever? Actually, keynote might be okay, because you could, you know, have the layout of your page, and keynote has those transitions in and out, so you can kind of like have a brick or something, by that I mean a square, just a rectangle on your page, and then apply there's all kinds of fade in, fade out, slide in, slide out type of stuff in Keynote. So that might be a good tool for that, that kind of thing.
I was going to say, now with JavaScript, like your app is really kind of a series of events, if you're using some sort of JavaScript framework. So I know when I made an iPhone app, like your iPhone app is really just a series of events, like view did load, view on unload, view, table did make a thing. And so in that sense, like maybe you have to just document each event. Gosh.
Sure.
Can I fire this one off?
Yeah.
Hopefully, getting deep there. Anyway, hopefully that worked out for
Bastian
you.
Bastian Hoffman asks a real quick one. How can I take JavaScript and PHP to a professional level? Very quick question there. I think the standard shop talk answer is to just build websites, of course.
Just build websites. Take money in exchange for these services.
Yeah, well, that's the definition of pro, right? Yeah.
Classes, like online courses, never hurt. JavaScript, if you use a lot of that. Boku does a lot of training. It's expensive, but it's professional training, and you'll learn how to do things the professional way.
That stuff is great. It's just, it does always sink in a lot more if you can bring home that training and turn it into a real thing that really does something. So definitely get yourself a real project and start solving the problems that you just need to solve, because it's your own project. So,
and we talk about this, like I want to learn Backbone, and I've determined the only way I'm actually going to learn it is if I build a little Backbone app,
Yeah. So it's literally the only way.
The only way. Or like I understand it, I get it, I've seen code, but until I've like put my hands in the mud, I don't understand it,
So yeah. Sometimes that's weird to force too, because you're like, I don't know. It's always been very hard for me to start with the goal of wanting to learn Backbone. It's easier for me to start with the goal of wanting to like eat a cupcake.
Sure. Yeah. Well,
More literally, like make a calendar app or whatever. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it. Maybe you need to make a website for cupcakes using PHP and JavaScript only. There you go. Hopefully that helps you out, Bastian. Man, we are rapid firing through these. John Hutchinson writes in, any thoughts on Modernizer? All right. Any reason not to use it? Oh, how much does it help with cross-browser compatibility?
Mm-hmm. Modernizer, as a lot of you know, is a Boolean framework. I think we've called it in the past. Its whole point in existence is to give you true false values on whether or not the browser that you're currently in. So this is only will give it to you on the client side. It's not a server side tool. Client side tool will tell you yes or no if the current browser you're in that has loaded this page, that feature is true or not. Very simple stuff like border radius, box shadow, CSS3 stuff, but also this HTML5 stuff like we talked about earlier, like push state and local storage. It will give you a true or a false.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So how does that help you with browser compatibility?
I mean, so with browser compatibility, it does two things. Like it actually has you can include a shiv into it, or a shim, whatever you want to call it. Cause one of them is apparently racist, but, you can, include that, and that'll actually fix some features for older browsers like IE 6.7 and 8 and Safari 3.2 and stuff
like
that.
Sure. That's a little add on that actually does help with some browser compatibility.
But now when you're testing features, your feature testing, and if you do it right, like you're progressively enhancing, you're saying every time you address a feature like local storage, you say if modernizer.localstorage, and that'll say yes or no, then do this. Otherwise, don't do anything at all, pretty much is usually the answer there. But
if the answer is don't do anything at all, then don't use it, because then it just is irrelevant. If the answer is I'm going to do something different depending on yes or no, if there's a fork in your code, you're going to do one thing if it's true and one thing if it's false. Modernizer is perfect.
Yeah. Think about like a canvas or something like that. You're like, if modernizer.canvas, and that'll say yes or no. Okay, cool. Make this cool little drawing app. And if it's like, no, I don't have Canvas, you're like, cool. Use this dumb Flash plugin I found 8 years ago.
That, right. Like, very different fork in the road there.
Yeah. And I mean, you're going to have to be a little sophisticated in how you deal with the fallbacks. But, you know, I mean, more or less, that's why you'd want to use it. Any reason not to use it?
Well, if the fork in the road isn't really a fork, it just doesn't, you're not planning to do a fallback.
Yeah.
For example, like HTML5 geolocation. Let's say you have a map, and if a geolocation is enabled, you're going to ask them for their geolocation, and then you're going to move that map to where they are. If they don't have geolocation, you're going to show a map like you were planning to do anyway. There's no fork in the road there. You don't need to test if it supports geolocation or not, because if it does, it'll do the thing, and if it doesn't, it doesn't. You don't need Modernizer for that. You do need Modernizer if you're using some effect that is absolutely required that it works, and you need to do something else if it doesn't work, like show a message that says, you know, whatever. You're going to have to type in your address here or whatever. You're going to have to take action. That's why I feel like Modernizer is never a part of the default web toolbox, because you need to kind of decide on a case-by-case basis whether you're going to do anything with it or not. And by itself, it doesn't provide you those solutions. So if you need a fallback for geolocation, it's kind of like bring your own. There was a little confusion, I feel like, for a time, because the type of people that talked about things like Modernizer were the same type of people on the web who talked about things like polyfills. And what's weird about a polyfill is a true polyfill does that Boolean true-false test anyway. If you need an HTML5 geolocation polyfill, you'll tend to go find one, and it'll tell you how to use it. And it will also have within it that same test that Modernizer is doing. And worse, the test will probably be a little different, which is funny, because it's like, well, okay, well, I should use Modernizer to load a polyfill. Not really, because that's like running that test twice then, which isn't the end of the world. Mm-hmm. It's just like, you know, you should, most of these polyfills should have like a don't run the test version of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like I BYO test.
Yeah.
But that's, or everyone should just depend on Modernizer. That's maybe my.
Right. Because they do most of the work in figuring this stuff out.
And they do it better. I mean, are there always
another reason this thing exists is because you're like, oh, geolocation, all you got to do is go window.location or whatever it is, the little API, and if window.location do this, else do something else. And you're like, yeah, that's what you could say about every test in Modernizer pretty much, and it's never true. There's always weird things about browsers that are wrong in that answer, that they claim to support it, but they really don't or whatever. And so they have advanced tests in theirs that are like, okay, you said you supported it, but let me really actually try to use it and see if it's true or not. There used to be like an implementation of VW units, you know, those things that are 1% as wide as the browser window. It's like a CSS setting thing. And it what used to be like, you'd have to set it to, it was just an incorrect, one browser had an incorrect implementation of it. So if you did a really basic test, it would say, oh yeah, worry, this browser supports that. But Modernizer needed to report that it didn't because it was so wrong. So that test is in Modernizer.
Yep. I'm trying to think, the only other, like, and hopefully you guys listening know this stuff, but like, don't use all Modernizer all the time. Like the full Modernizer, Modernizer has a builder. It was made by Alex Sexton, who's been on the show. You can basically custom tailor and only test the features you're actually going to use on your website. And that'll reduce the file size. It's only 42K uncompressed, which isn't huge. You know, it's like a JPEG. But at the same time, you don't want extra tests and overhead that might...
All that stuff matters.
Yeah. It's wasting milliseconds, really. So don't do it. Anyway.
Who knows, though? You know, because it does weird stuff, Modernizer. It has to, like, inject stuff onto the page and then measure it. And stuff like that. It's like, it's 42K, but it also does a bunch of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you like watch it, it like in slow motion, if you're to do that, it like writes a bunch of divs and appends a bunch of stuff. And yeah, I wouldn't, I mean, only use it on what you need to. That would be my, you know.
Enough.
All right. That was a short gun blast. I need to set this up to where it can like, oh, maybe if I hit that button. Hey, button, do a thing. Nope.
Pretty good.
All right, yeah. I'll work on it. All right.
John Hutchinson asks, oh, we already did that one. You got your answer, John. Travis Nielsen asks, what is the best semantic tag for marking up an alert or notification? We read that the aside tag is for content tangentially related to the content surrounding it. So Travis is thinking maybe aside is good for alerts. Thoughts?
I would say, I don't know. I don't know that I'm super worried about whether it's an aside or a div. What I would be more worried about is whether or not ARIA roles have been applied. And now I'm getting...
What is the ARIA role for an alert?
Well, there's, you know, there might be an alert, but there's like two kinds that might apply here. There's a dialogue, like ARIA role equals dialogue, which would be like a modal that pops up, right? That somebody has to interact with. You know, you have an empty div somewhere that you inject messages into, and you'd say ARIA live equals polite or ARIA live equals aggressive or what. There's another one. I can't remember. I'm the worst accessibility guy in the whole darn planet. So that's saying like when you inject into there, you're like the screen reader, for example, will say like, okay, cool. Once I'm done reading content, I'm going to inform this person, in a polite manner or I think there might even be a rude. I'm going to Google this real quick, but it basically just says like, okay, now I'm going to say error. You suck.
ARIA live equals rude. That's amazing.
I want to find out. All right. I'm going to Google it. Googling things.
Oh, that's cool. That's neat. And wouldn't focus also matter? Like if all of a sudden you inject a div on the page, which often these alerts are appended to the page because they are a result of some kind of action in JavaScript.
Yeah.
Would you then focus that H1 tag that's within it? Would that be smart or not smart?
I wouldn't mess with focus. The ARIA attribute should control the focus, you know? Because it should redirect. So it's off, which is default, right? Polite and assertive. So
assertive
is like, dude, I changed something. Listen to me now. Polite's like, I'm going to just read the rest of the page and then I'm going to tell you about this thing, right? Or whenever there's a free moment, I'm going to just tell you some more information. So
that's interesting. So you'd think assertive would be probably... I don't know. I mean, let's think of a real situation. There's alerts all over CodePen. When you go to delete a pen, you literally have selected a menu option that says delete this pen. We append a div at the on the page. It would be ARIA, whatever, aggressive probably, right? Because we want them to confirm that message right away.
Mm-hmm.
Or
mm-hmm.
not. I don't even know. I mean,
you'd probably want to.
The chances
like...
of you reading a paragraph of text is pretty low on CodePen anyway.
Yeah, well, and most, like, if you do ARIA live or whatever, it's going to, like, put it onto there. And then, like, if you want to close it out, they would just, a screen reader user or a sighted, you know, keyboard user would just have to hit tab to go to the button that closes it, right? But, yeah, I'm looking at an MDN here and just, like, go MDN ARIA live or whatever. And they're saying, like, places where... well-defined or well-known predefined cases, it's better to use a specific provided ARIA live role, would be log, status, alert, progress bar, marquee, timer. So I don't, you know, this bothers me. I mean, it would seem like maybe there is another way. Okay, I'm going to get there, guys. I'm reading documentation on the air. This is stupid. I'm going to stop it. But anyway, we'll get there, team. But there's a lot of
blog posts probably because it's so, I mean, how often does this come up? you know, dialogue boxes and alerts and stuff and apps. And if there was some settled upon best way of handling it for common situations, it would be worth spreading the word on that a bit.
Yeah. So that's my final answer. I don't know, Chris, do you have a...
I don't know. I kind of, the more I think about it, the aside tag is interesting to me, but I wouldn't lose sleep over that type of thing. But you know, the strict definition of it does seem to make sense for what, but I mean, if we turn off this podcast and I go work on CodePen and mark up an alert, am I actually going to do it? I'd probably use a div. I just, you know,
and div. Oh, yeah. So it looks like there is a role equals alert is what I'm seeing here. But, you know, who knows if that's implemented by any browser, you know?
Right.
Ugh, this is where accessibility gets so confusing. Anyway.
Okay. Well, we tried.
Well, yep. We'll get there. We'll get there, team. Together, we can. Check this out. Oh, wait. What? Did it not go? Oh. Yes.
So what's dangerous about guns? You pull the trigger, they don't fire. You look down the barrel and all of a sudden they fire.
Yeah.
It's ask, you know.
Dangerous fake toys we have
here. Ask Wile E. Coyote.
Duncan Smith writes in, I recently got a coupon for a free Backbone JS course. While I'm grateful, I'm not exactly sure what Backbone.js is for or why I would ever use it. I've heard it described as an MVC JavaScript or MVC framework or an MVP framework and various other MVStar type things. However, it seems like it's trying to do the job of the backend. I don't understand why it exists or what the primary use case would be. If you guys could shed some light on the subject, it would be awesome. Thanks, guys.
I don't even want in. I'm going to just say before Dave actually explains it, that Backbone.js is kind of on my list of shame, as we sometimes mention on the show. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things where, like, I don't get it. So I'm going to have to work on it at some point so I get it. Not that I'm, like, completely clueless because I could get it. I'm not, like, worried that my career is in shambles because I don't understand this one thing. But it's something that I would pick for a level up weekend should we do some such thing like that in the future.
Heck yeah.
It's even more embarrassing to me because I was in when I went to New Zealand, I spent a week in a car with Jeremy Ashkenas, who's the creator of Backbone.js, and we didn't even mention it. We were too busy like screwing her off, you know. But I don't know. You know, I mean, surely he could explain it. Maybe that'd be a good guest, although he's like currently touring the world or something. It would be hard to get on the show, but I don't get it. Explain to me what Backbone.js is.
Okay. So Backbone.js and its friends Ember.js and Angular.js and maybe even Meteor.js, they help you build, like evented views. If you're following me here, they help you build like a system based. So you have models, which are like your data. That's your data. Views. This is the M in the view.
Like a template.
In the C. Views are templates, right? Handlebars, JS, for example, or something like that. Some sort of thing that renders HTML. And then controller is all your logic. So your controller, your view says, hey, controller, I need something. And your controller goes, hey, model, give me all the data. And the model goes, here's all the data, controller says, thank you. I'm going to just make this pretty and do all these things that I want to it. And then boom, view, template that mess. Does that make sense? Did I describe that pretty
well? It does. And you did do a very good job in it. And if, for someone who understands MVC, it's like, okay, I totally get it. You confirmed my thinking of what MVC is. If somebody out there still doesn't get it, don't feel bad. It took me forever to understand what MVC is. Once you've worked on a Rails project or two, the distinction between M and V and C are very clear. Mm-hmm. There's helpers, different controllers, folders, and right? Yeah, they're literally in different folders, and it makes sense. And you're like, oh, dang, this view is so sexy clean. Then you get to this point where you're like, ooh, I'm going to put a little logic in this view, and you're like, nah, I'm going to move that to the controller where logic is supposed to be. And you feel all proud of yourself, and then the concept of MVC really starts to sink in. And honestly, I don't understand exactly how that ports to JavaScript still. Like, yeah. I understand that the view could be a handlebars, but like, and then as far as I understand it, that like the C is the variable. That's what Adi Osmani often says, right? Is the controller is the thing that like all these different frameworks choose to handle in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, I don't even know what MVP, minimum viable product, but anyway, the most
valuable player, dude.
Most valuable player, Bo Jackson.
Bow breaker.
I totally agree with Chris. It took me a solid month of like learning Cake PHP to like learn what MVC actually did and how it actually all works together. So like, don't worry if that makes no sense to you, but the controller is just, it's your logic. It's what chews through data. So usually if you're familiar with jQuery, for example, Rebecca Murphy calls it the like select things and do SHIT with it. So it's just
that's
like
what jQuery calls itself too. Okay. jQuery doesn't even fit into this model really.
Right. No, not at all. So like, that's what jQuery does. jQuery is just like, yeah, just give me everything and I'm just going to do stuff to it, you know? But like, this is more like you have an asynchronous application. So when you click that button knows to like go fetch more data and then repopulate and redo another view without even like refreshing the page.
Even Duncan says here, it seems like it's trying to do the job of the back end, which perhaps it is in a way.
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of the biggest complaints with JavaScript MVCs are that they, you've duplicated the work. Like your front end now has to do your back end, blah blah blah. But if you look at it in the context of Node.js, in theory, and I don't know how this works firsthand, those controllers and those views and those models should be able to exist on client and browser just fine. It should be the same code. So there you go.
Yeah, it really does mess with our. I was just, there's some AngularJS demos up on CodePen now, and it's pretty interesting, you know, like it shares some of the bits of Mustache. So I saw one, just the other day, what's the guy's name? Anyway, there was like two number inputs, and the number inputs had some attributes on them, and then there was a div, and the div was set to the width and height of whatever those number inputs were, and there was inline styles on that div that changed size, and it just said style, you know, width equals handlebar, handlebar, width or whatever. And height equals handlebar, handlebar, height. And as you change those number inputs, it would just automatically change the width and height of the div. There was no JavaScript written on the page at all. Just because AngularJS existed on that page, that functionality worked. So it's like, you know, it's like writing less and just like expecting what this framework is going to do is pretty weird.
Yeah. Yeah. That's like Meteor does the same thing. It's like, it's sort of like auto appification.
Yes, and that's a word.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, holy moly, like this has replaced like a team of developers. But you know, I mean, use it. I don't see why
you're
not.
You're stuck though, man. If you go down that road,
that's maybe the thing. I think Backbone's probably the most flexible compared to all those other ones, in from what I've seen, but. But yeah, you're exactly right, Chris. A lot of technical debt there.
What do we got?
Let's fire a gun. Let's shoot things.
I like that.
Kibbs Hussein writes in. Yeah,
you do it.
Okay. Do you serve one style sheet to all devices, starting with the CSS for small screens and then introducing media queries as the screen size gets bigger? Or would it be better to call different style sheets in the HTML so the user only downloads the style sheet they need, resulting in the user not having to download an entire style sheet?
Really good question, I think. Mm-hmm. A lot of us that work on responsive designs, we just serve it all at once. And there's media queries within the style sheet to handle it when the browser meets one of those new media queries. So if you're using a mobile first philosophy, use min width media queries. And so you write a bunch of CSS to make your page look right, let's say on a phone. And then as soon as it gets to, 700 pixels, this new set of Java or CSS takes place and it, you know, shuffles some things around. But all of that information is in one file. so that all devices get all of that. And Kibbs is asking, would it be cool if we just separated those out into three different files? And the correct one downloads when the browser window is of that size.
So do you have an opinion on this? I well, tend to do all of them. I mean, and here's why. Here's my feelings. Here's my honest feelings. My media queries aren't like super duper, right? Like when I end up, when I finally got mobile first figured out and stuff like that, and I was writing my media queries, I mean, they're only like 100 bytes or, you know, maybe 1 kilobyte, you know, stuff I don't feel super bad, you know, sending down with everything, as opposed to making a separate request and making the user wait that much longer and causing a repaint and blah, blah, blah. So I'm very like, I feel very comfortable like bundling them all together. It's just like minifying JavaScript all in one file. It's like, sure, it's bigger and not everyone needs everything, but it's just happening. And now, especially with SAS and all that, I do not write my CSS in a way where it's like mobile, tablet, desktop. Like I only have 2 media queries, so I don't even write that way anymore. So it would be very difficult for me to bundle all those style sheets. I feel like, I guess you could with your mama bear, papa bear thing, huh?
Yeah. So can you do one more time? When do you not bundle? Are there situations where you're loading in Dynamics?
When do you want to like split it apart? Like 320 and up is a good example. They split it up, you know, into like you write all your media, you write all your CSS for your small
then
view.
You split it up with the link tag.
Yeah. With the link tag. Mm. And there's actually a problem there because Scott Gell found out browsers don't even pay attention to that. They just download all the links.
No, of course they do. Yeah, that's never been the case. Like even a print style sheet. You'd think if any case in the world, the browser would just download that print style sheet when you hit the print button. Wouldn't you think? No, it doesn't. Nope. Of course, it downloads it immediately. I think Scott is making the case for that would be really cool and really useful browsers if you would stop doing that. Mm-hmm. And if they did that, if they started to do that, we would start moving to it, I bet, right away. Because how cool would that be?
Yeah, I mean, the first app that would be written would be like a CSS post-processor that would go through your CSS, harvest all your media queries,
and split it up.
And split it up, right?
I mean, yeah, probably.
That would be super radical. But like,
but the reason that because the browsers are going to download them all anyway, we end up pushing them all into one file because that's just more performant anyway. Unless the file's like enormously huge, which it's probably not. You know, CSS files these days, I just don't think, especially with flat design, CSS is getting a little smaller. But yeah, okay. So, Kibbs, here's the other reason. Let's say that you could detect somehow on the server side what size that browser window is and serve the right file then. That it gets a little more compelling because you can just tell what size the browser window is from the server side, and the server will make the determination about what it serves up. Mm-hmm. That would be pretty cool. And a lot of people think that's so cool that they're willing to user agent sniff to try to make those kind of decisions. They think they can pretty accurately tell if they're on an iPhone or some kind of tablet or whatever and make that decision and serve up the right file. Yeah. You'd be wrong about that, but they would make those just kind of decisions. I've just recently delved into the world of UA sniffing a little bit for CodePen because I thought that maybe, you know, like if you used an open source library that was pretty popular, like some Ruby gem or whatever, that you could, that was like, you know, kept up to date pretty good, that you could make a couple of decisions on this that would be okay. Mm-hmm. Like don't bet the farm on it, but make little tiny decisions to make it
little
better.
Insignificant.
Even that, it's disaster.
Disaster.
Yeah, it really sucks. You, like try to tell if you're on a Kindle Fire or not. Good luck. You're gonna get the desktop version or however you write the logic, you're gonna get the wrong one. Pretty much. That's what the Kindle Fire reports. It's the opposite of what you want. Anyway, it's just not a good idea. But let's say that. So wouldn't that be cool, though, if at least somebody was working on more reliable way to tell this kind of thing, and they are, and that's what the client hints thing is. And there was, you know, a little bit of drama around this, and some of the, you know, filament group guys seem a little unhappy about what's making it into client hints 1.0. But it's kind of like it would be a very nice if the browser would start sending us client information instead of just a user agent string. I mean, that sucks right now that all we have is this dumb string to work off of. What if along with the user agent string, we got like, oh, this browser is 800 pixels wide right now, and it supports 2x media resolution. And we could make decisions server side based on that information that reports to us.
And the browser's
awesome.
Unscalable. That would be kind of helpful.
And all kinds of capabilities of that thing. That would be amazing if that just came across. And you know, it's complicated.
If Modernizer was a two-way street, that would be sweet.
Yeah, like server-side Modernizer.
I mean,
what a lot of people do instead is they test all these things with JavaScript. Right on that first page load, they test them all. They like the full Modernizer suite, and they set a cookie, and in that cookie is all that information. What its size is, the browser, what things do it support, or whatever. And on the next request, or maybe they just refresh the page right away. On the next request, you have all that information. Great, right? That's not too bad. And I'm kind of leaning towards trying some of that stuff on CSS Tricks, but then it's like, how long do you have the cookie around? How awkward is that initial refresh? How much data do you store on that cookie? Because that goes across on every request. And like, how reliable is it? What if I have the browser window really narrow and I refresh the page with an empty cookie? Am I going to get, even on a desktop browser, am I going to get the mobile layout? Like, how can I smartly handle that? And is there a way to invalidate that cookie that makes sense? And it's also complicated, but it's better than UA string testing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Ibs, we went too far on that.
We took you down a dark path.
You should bundle.
Don't even think about it. Bundle it. Unless you're really messing up at CSS. I hate to be that. I'm that jerk. I mean, like, if your desktop CSS and your mobile CSS are like megs in difference, you know, but whatever. They're not. Trust me. There you go.
I got to do a sponsor here. I'm very happy to have WooFoo, and I call them my tech alma mater because they were. Those the very first, like, really big web app I worked on. And I worked on some app-like stuff before WooFoo because I worked for a design agency and we worked on lots of different little stuff. But WooFoo is the first, like, big, hardcore, scale startup I worked for. And they're still just doing a great job today. So WooFoo.com is literally an online form builder. So the whole point of it is to build a form that ends up going onto your website. I mean, you can use the WooFoo hosted version, but the vast majority of WooFoo forms are that you finish building it and you get some copy and paste code from WooFoo and you put it on your own website. So it could be a contact form for a website, or it could be a payment form to sell t-shirts, the Shop Talk t-shirt sell form, WooFoo form. You could have big multi-page forms because you need to like ask clients this big questionnaire of stuff. Let's say you're a design agency and you make them do what do you call those things? RFPs or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You have a 5-page RFP because you're just so busy of an agency that you need, you know, you have to ask a lot of questions. You're essentially making clients jump through a hoop because you don't want to even deal with them unless they're willing to deal with you, you know? Mm-hmm. You could have they take payments. Oh, we already covered that one, right? You'll never have to worry about spam with WooFoo. Not only does it kind of have its own spam detection kind of stuff, but if a form really gets crazy, it automatically injects a CAPTCHA in there. There's not a CAPTCHA right away, but if we detect weird material, then there becomes a CAPTCHA in there. There's just so many things. Like, yes, I know you can create your own web forms, but WooFoo can do it better. You know, just the on-page logic, that's the best in WooFoo. It's like, if this value, you know, if this dropdown is this, then reveal this additional field. How do you create that kind of logic? Isn't that weird and kind of mind-bending? Well, it would be, except for WooFoo's the rule builder, I call it in WooFoo, is really nice at that. You eventually fill out a sentence. You know, you like if, and then you like pull a drop down. It's like, and you pick the field is equal to this value, and all these things are drop downs. So you're basically like crafting this sentence, so it like really makes logical sense to you. about how that logic should behave, and then save it, and it works great. So there's a theme designer, use your own custom fonts and colors and logos and all that stuff, or load your own CSS. So a lot of you guys are hardcore advanced. You can just load up your own CSS and have full design control, however the form looks, but still have all the power of WooFoo. Things like, let's say you have a contact form, but you have an email newsletter too, and you want them to have automatically signed up to your email newsletter on MailChimp or Campaign Monitor. When they fill out that contact form, boom, easy. You just put your MailChimp API key in there and connect a few fields and you're good to go. You know, write that yourself. You could. It'll take you all day, but you could do it, you know? Like, why mess with that? Just have WooFoo do it.
Dude, WooFoo, I go to bed at night thinking, wow, I should have just done WooFoo. It's
file uploading. I'm just not going to go on because I hope that they'll sponsor more shows in the future, but I'm just such a big fan, of course. That's why I work there at all, and I help build a lot of this stuff. So I heartily endorse all that is WooFoo. Anyway, let's do another question, and then we have one more sponsor. We waited a little late this week, but this one's worth waiting for just to hear the sponsor because it's a really cool conference. So
all right. So Dimitar Belchugov. Belchigov writes in and says, do you know of a tool that minifies data URI images? I want to shorten the process of saving the data URI and converting it with Smushit and then converting again with data URI.
I never really think about that. I always think of, so data URI is just like, let's say you have a JPEG and you just were to open that JPEG in Sublime Text, it would just be this string of gibberish, right? Mm-hmm. You can put that string of gibberish right in HTML or CSS if you put the right little headers before it. That way it doesn't have to load an additional resource. It's just in there. It makes the document all big and gross, but you can do it. And it's kind of nice for little tiny simple icons where it's not too much gross stuff in there. But I never really think of compressing those or minifying those. Like, yeah. I always kind of assume that those are already pretty minified, but maybe they're not, you know?
Yeah, interesting. I mean, it seems like a tool that you could build or... I mean, shoot, some of these tools have to have like public facing things, right? Like dataURI.me or what? DURI me. That's pretty clever.
Compass has a thing. So you can, you know, you don't have to put all that. If you're pre-processing, you can just say, you know, I don't know. I can't even remember what the exact function is in Compass, but there's a thing that just allows you to put like data URI parentheses and then put the file path in there, and then when Compass compresses it will end up being a data URI. Mm-hmm. I just learned that Emmet has a keyboard command where if you're ever on a URL path, you can press this keyboard command, and of course I can't remember what it is right now, but you just press the keyboard
Control
command
alt,
and it just
delete.
Definitely not what Dave just said. It's something like
no,
Control Option 5 or something.
Yeah, Command W or Alt F4. And then it'll instantly convert it.
You punch your monitor at the end.
Good.
But yeah, however you could minify or compress an image anyway, you would just do that first. And I don't know of an automatic data URI compressing thing, you know? You're just gonna have to compress it how you would have anyway, and then get the data URI out of that compressed file.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't think it would be too difficult to code out, were I to say very boldly that you could code this out. I mean, because you're just adding a step before you spit it out, right? I would reach out to some people. And I, cause all these things like Smushit and whatever, they have an API or whatever. So
Maybe that's with how the Emmet one should have worked, is before it converts it, it should smush it first. But probably not. Cause it's, you know, what if you're on a plane then or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
Let's kill it.
Okay. Oh, let me cue up the old sound effects. Just more.
I have a feeling it's on a separate tab, and Dave wasn't on that tab.
You know, it's on an iPad now, and it falls asleep. So, need to fix that.
Mark Fu, this is an audio question, or is this one the one that didn't work?
This one works. So, okay, here we go. Mark Fu writes in, and audio question, here we go.
I would like to start using better quality fonts for my client projects, But because most font services generally are subscription-based, I can see this complicating the final estimate for a project proposal. For example, is it better for the client to be responsible for handling their own subscriptions? Or would it be easier for the developer to handle one deluxe subscription that can accommodate all client projects? If you and your guests have had similar experience dealing with this, I would love to hear about it. Thanks, guys.
Subscriptions.
You do more of this stuff, so you get to answer.
Oh, man, I don't really do much subscription stuff, but...
Well, let's say you
like
did,
font
though.
Stuff. Yeah, so, like, for us, like, yeah, sorry. I immediately jumped into, like, billing subscription because that's what I'm thinking of right now. But font services, we always make our clients get that. Like, set that up, set up an account, give us a login, and we'll log in. I mean, you could consider like rehosting through your client, but you know, what's going to happen is they'll leave you and then they're really upset. Like, they're like, I didn't understand that you had our fonts and now our guy's upset or blah, blah, blah. I mean,
oh, it's a recipe for disaster. There's no good in you paying for this hosted service. Mm-hmm. Right from the get-go, I don't think. You might as well establish, hey, these fonts, they're hosted by this other service. It costs this much a month. Why don't you just sign up for it? And we'll, you know, then we'll use those great fonts, you know? And then, I don't know, just making that transparent to the client seems like a mess.
Yeah, and they may not see the value. I mean,
then don't do it.
Google web font that. Yeah. But, I mean, it's sort of one of those things, like every client we've had that, like, we explain what's going on. They're like, oh yes, easy. Let me do that. I'll do that. So, we did though have a client recently. We were like, okay, cool. So set up Proxima Nova, you know, just the old standard. And, they were like, oh wait, hold on. We need to check with our brand guy. And it turned out they had a different font apparently. So, found that out. That was cool. So, you know, I guess, like, let them know what's going on. I would make them do it. And I would do that with hosting, too. I know a lot of people, like,
get that's what I was just going to say. And domain ownership.
Domain owner, let them do it. And then when it falls apart and they forget.
Doesn't mean you can't help them.
Because they're going to forget to pay the bill and you help them out with that, right? But if they forget to pay the bill and they get a million hits a month and that's costing you money, that's a problem for you. But
it's about the future relationship more so to me. Like, if anything goes sour, they got everything they need.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I would just say, like, if you get an email from a hosting company, let them know what, and talk to me by all means. Like, you kind of can maybe run hosting from a client perspective, like, to help your client out. But we got into the hosting game and like, we love all of our clients, but man, are we done in 5 years down the line? Like, we thought we were like, dude, saving so much. We're making like $3,000 a year or something. I don't know. I'm just like, and you just think this is epic amounts of money. And it's like, yeah, that was very nice, you know, but like,
for the cost of your stress or whatever.
Yeah. Like, how many Saturdays have I spent, like, whatever, cleaning out a hack or something like that, like, because all of our sites got hacked because whatever my host got hacked. You know, it's just like, it's not worth, it doesn't end up being worth it, you know? So do not. Is that my, there you go. So, yeah. Not.
Okay. Are you ready? Here's the URL, 2013.cssdevconf.com. So that's it. It's the CSS DevConf. It's the 2013 version of it at the Stanley Hotel in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado. So it's near Denver-ish, but it's probably in some small town outside of it that's probably super beautiful and awesome and totally worth going to. It's all about CSS. So some of the most favorite conferences I've ever been to in my lifetime of going to conferences. One was like the jQuery conference, just because it was so cool. It was so specific about jQuery. I've only ever been to one of them, but I remember liking how specific it was and how everybody's on the same page and talking about the same thing and the chances of there being like little in-room hacking going on and, hey, look at my code type of stuff going on is super high because it's so specific. That's the same kind of thing at CSS DevConf. It's all about CSS. We're all talking about this seemingly simple thing and all the multitudes of complication that comes with it. Eric Meyer is going to be there. I just saw him speak recently. You're going to want to hear what Eric has to say. Still, you know, the king of CSS that he always was, has very relevant and important things to say about CSS. He generally turns out to be right about everything. Nicole Sullivan's going to be there. OOCSS captain, now talking about preprocessors and stuff. I don't know what she's going to talk about there, but it's probably going to be awesome. So Gillenwater, I just linked to one of her posts yesterday on CSS Tricks because she's a CSS genius still. Snook, what can I say about Snook? Estelle Weil, a master of the millions of weird CSS syntax things you can know. Tab Atkins, who shapes the future of CSS. They're all going to be there and more. This October 21st through 23rd, in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado. So definitely check that out and go to there. The webpage is already up. It's pretty cool.
Sweet.
I don't think we have a discount for that one yet.
Yeah, we don't. But keep your ears to the ground. I mean, we love Environments for Humans, and they like some of my favorite conferences. So awesome. Like, it's gonna be. I can like guarantee the quality of it.
One of the best people out there, Austin.
Austin, Texas. Remember that time that dude asked about Austin? That was awesome. Yeah. That was the best day of my life.
Why Austin, he says.
Well, Willie Nelson. Here we go.
Let's end with one more. Is there, did I? Oh, no. Gosh, I was looking at earlier question. I'm like, man, it seems so long ago now.
All right, here we go. This is a little hot drama here. You guys are ready for this one? Matt McGlade writes in, "Hi, great show. One I look forward to hearing every week, exclamation. What are your guys' views of SEO in general? I've worked in several different web environments, and there seems to be a lot of talk about best SEO practices, all slightly different. I've seen a lot of conflicting opinions on the web, too. But in contrast, I've also heard a lot of developers saying it's mostly bunk and that the only way to have a good site high up in Google is to have a good site with good content. So is all this SEO useless, or are there some things, such as keeping site structures the same, worth doing?" Wah, 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 wah. One more. Cool. SEO.
Do you want to start it out here?
Here's my views of SEO, right? Right. Here's the deal. I do this to my wife all the time. It's terrible. I'm like, here's the deal. And I explain things. I mansplain her real well. It's good. I mean, SEO is a real thing, right? Or in your search ranking is a good thing, right? I feel very strongly that white hat is the only way to go. There may be an SEO trick you heard about, like, make alt tags super, super long and descriptive and loaded with keywords. That's false. Like, just code the best website you could possibly code. But there are things, you know, that you have to consider. I mean, people have like reverse engineered Google's PageRank, you know, like they'll put up one page with 1% keywords, another page with 2%, another with 40% or whatever. And like
That stuff is crazy. Like, does that work?
Well, I mean, it's all weird, right? I mean, it's just like, it's bizarre.
What are the chances of a paragraph being a good, well-written, readable paragraph if it was mathematically calculated what percentage of keywords are going to be in that paragraph? Like zero, right? Like is a computer-generated paragraph at this point.
Well, and it's like the day Google's like, yep, nope, 32% is the best. And like, dude, you're boned. You got to come up with something else. So,
because Google made that decision based probably on real good paragraphs that would come out of your mouth and fingers if you had just written it with honesty.
Yeah. I mean, so I feel like there's like, it's something you have to pay attention to, and it's something you should be considering when you code. So don't just write garbage, don't write black hat stuff like hidden lists of links and stuff like that. But the most successful way to get traffic is to build a useful site that people want to visit. I mean, like, and if you can make a site,
when they do visit it, they spend time there, Google can tell that kind of thing. And when, and that, you know, I don't know. There's I often think of Yoast, you know, that dude.
Yeah.
Like he has an SEO plugin. He does SEO services. He's a legit SEO guy. He's not going to come in and tell you black hat stuff. Imagine what Yoast would tell you if you were to hire him. What kind of things would he look for when he went through your site? He'd probably look at titles, you know, he'd look at the title attribute of all your pages. Are those nice and clean, and do they make sense and not loaded with garbage and are in a consistent kind of structure? You know, how are your, I don't know, just, but it's, of course, he's not even going to worry about your content. He's not going to write your own content for you. He's probably a starting with the assumption that your content is also just good, normal, legit kind of content.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's going to, but maybe he knows some useful stuff, like one of the things people tell me all the time at CSS Tricks is that they see my face in the Google search results. Mm-hmm. I'm not even sure exactly how that works. Yoast probably knows. So he'll hook that up. He'll find some way. You know, I think you have to claim your site on Google Plus or something.
Ah, thing, there you know? Go.
So yeah. That's like something that would be worth knowing and doing because that it works. But that, you know, anything that seems trick like is just dumb.
Yeah. There's, you just reminded me. Oh yeah. Like the other thing about all these tricks and stuff is like, yeah, if you Google anything nowadays, like it searches within your network of friends, like using your Google Plus network. It searches locally. It knows where you're at. So it'll give you local results kind of bumped up over global results or like whatever Russia results or something. So it's like social, it's local, like, the whole idea that you can be the top spot on Google, I think, is totally bunk now. I don't even think it's possible.
And, to buy your way up to it or whatever with tricks?
Yeah, to trick your way up. I mean, like, you're basically like, I'm going... It's like a heist movie, right? Like, dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum. I'm going to trick the smartest computer in the world to put me at the top of a search result for dingleberries. And yeah. That, like... I mean, it's like you're the king, but and that may make a difference to your company, but the way I sort of see it is like, if you don't have a good, if your company, if that website is not something somebody would go to like on their own or whatever, then that's an SEO problem. I mean, I don't know. Like
it's tough. That's a company problem. Think of a real world example of like, you're on Austin, Texas, you know,
web design like, company,
not even, well, okay. Maybe, but or like a car, you know, like a mechanic.
Yeah.
And so this guy, he fixes cars, or girl that has fixes cars. He doesn't have time to mess around with content on their site. They want a site that's a one and done. It says the hours that they're open as the name of it on there. Maybe it has a map to where they are, and that's about it. It's legitimate that the proprietor of this mechanic, though, would want to rank higher than they do. If they do a search for Austin mechanic and they're just not there, I can see that they want to approach the SEO gods for help.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I'm always at. So there's always us being, you know, make sure you have good titles and H1 tags and stuff. But I do feel the need. You know, I understand where people are coming from when they just think that's not enough. You know, they just, I did that stuff. I don't understand. And this is where I fail. And I don't really know what to tell you. You know, well, try Google Business Search. I don't know.
Yeah, that stuff's important. I mean, again, I think that what would Yoast do is the best.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the best rule of thumb. I mean, just dig into the Yoast SEO plugin and like, say, like, build out a little check sheet on what you need to do based on the features he's coded up. I mean, yeah. There you go. Yeah. Yeah.
Even stuff like SEO Moz has big tools and services, you know, and stuff you can use.
SEO Moz, I believe it, yeah. They have a guide to SEO for beginners. The free, they use the word free. Okay, the free beginner's guide to SEO. And like, so here you go. I mean, it's SEO Moz. They wrote like 10 chapters for you on SEO. And there you go. I mean, I would I that's the best way, I think, to get into it. I was going to say, we had a lot of luck in, we built a site for a home builder in Lufkin, Texas, right? Mm-hmm. Lufkin, Texas might not be as ahead of the times as you imagine for web stuff, at least back then. You know, so we built this site for this home builder, pulled no punches. We just made a website, and like, he was at the top of the search results, and like most of his business, he was like, dude, I'm getting calls from my website, you know? And that's, we didn't do any kind of, hold on. we didn't do any kind of fancy stuff. We just, you know, we just coded a website, and it worked out really well for him. So there you go. My dog is getting very upset.
That's a good story, though. I'm glad you got to share a good success story.
Is that okay? I mean, I just like, hold on. My dog's very upset. There's other dogs outside. This is the most awful thing.
I wish they were together right now. Digby is so bored.
So anyway, that's like, yeah, this is the witching hour for her. Anyway, sometimes when she jumps up on the window to like look out at other dogs, she farts. It's pretty hilarious. But anyway, on that note, where are we at? Anyway,
no, we're about to wrap up. So that was a good thing about SEO. Please, you know, if anybody has more thoughts on this, we have comments on the site now. So I love that people chime in with more thoughts on it. And the story keeps going after the show is over. Make sure to visit our sponsors, 2013.cssdevconf.com and woofoo.com. And Dave, we got a little outro.
Yeah, I guess, you know, follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. Buy stuff at the store, shoptalkshow.com/store. Rate us up in iTunes. That's how people find out about this show. Tweet about us. Write love letters in public to us.
That would be nice.
Anyway, so
if you're like unmarried and, you know.
Yeah.
Into podcasters.
Not married, like podcasters named Chris. Call in. No. Hello, Montana from Montana. You're online. That's good. All right. Anyhow, I'm going to wrap this up. Chris, you got anything to say?
Oh, shoptalkshow.com.